to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, or online at KFAI.org. Well, so am I.
Yeah, me too.
Shouldn't everybody?
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and 106.7 FM in St. Paul, streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Steve McKellistrom.
And I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right on Radio, we speak with Jay Perini about his newly released volume of poems, New and Collected Poems, 1975 to 2015. He is also the author of The Last Station, made into an Academy Award-nominated film starring Helen Mirren and Christopher Plummer, as well as many other novels and biographies, including his most recent, Empire of Self, A Life of Gore Vidal.
So stay tuned for Right on Radio.
Welcome, Dylan Hicks.
No, Jay Perini.
Welcome, Jay Perini, excuse me.
Jay Perini.
I'm confused already. We haven't even started.
That's right.
Hi, Jay. Go ahead and
Hello, is this Ian?
Yes. Go ahead and
Ian, let me start off by reading my 9/11 poem, After the Terror.
Perfect.
Sound okay?
Yes.
It's my 9/11 villanelle. Emily Dickinson once said, after great pain, a formal feeling comes, and I always say, there's no more formal feeling a poet can have than the urge to write a villanelle.
Okay.
So here we go, After the Terror. Everything has changed, though nothing has. They've changed the locks on almost every door, and windows have been bolted just in case. It's business as usual, someone says. Is anybody left to mind the store? Everything has changed, though nothing has. The same old buildings huddle in the haze with faces at the windows, floor by floor, the windows they have bolted just in case. No cause for panic, they maintain, because the streets go places they have been before. Everything has changed, though nothing has. We're still a country that is ruled by laws. The system's working, and it's quite a bore that windows have been bolted just in case. Believe in victory and all that jazz. Believe we're better off, that less is more. Everything has changed, though nothing has. The windows have been bolted just in case.
Oh, fabulous. You were just listening there to Jay Perini reading from New and Collected Poems, 1975 to 2015. Jay's published five books of poetry, including Anthracite Country and House of Days. He's written eight novels, including Benjamin's Crossing, The Apprentice Lover, The Passages of H.M., And The Last Station, which we mentioned earlier, was made into an Academy Award-nominated film starring Helen Mirren and Christopher Plummer, one of my favourite films of all time. Perrine has written biographies of John Steinbeck, Robert Frost, William Faulkner, and most recently Gore Vidal. His non-fiction works include Jesus, The Human Face of God, Why Poetry Matters, and Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. Welcome back to Right on Radio, Jay Perrine.
It's fun to be back on your show. I'm talking with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I loved that poem, After the Terror. Just tell us what a villanelle is.
Well, a villanelle is one of those. There's very few good ones. I think people might know Dylan Thomas. Do not go gentle into that good night.
Yep.
Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. It's a very formal Provençal form that has, there's seven stanzas or six stanzas, and there's three lines in each stanza. They rhyme A-B-A, 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 and then finally A-B-A-A. And the first and third line of the first stanza become then the refrains of every subsequent stanza, and then they have to become the conclusion. So it's got that wonderful, rigid, old-fashioned form to it.
Yeah.
And so the trick is to make the stanza, the repeating lines, the refrains, keep shifting meaning and becoming more interesting or more complicated with every progressive stanza.
Wonderful stuff. You know, this book, we'll get into a conversation about, the larger entity of this book, but some of these opening poems that you have are fantastic. This is an older, slightly older one, but my goodness, you've got an incredible range through this book. And I'd read some of your poetry before, and of course, but I'm more familiar, of course, with your fiction and some of your academic work. But this blew me away. I sat on my, I think I texted you, I was saying that yesterday, I think it was, I was on my deck reading some of these things. And I was reading this particular poem, After the Terror. And a plane went over and roared and shook the whole building and the trees and everything as I was reading it. And it was very interesting to have that throw me back to the day when that all happened. And I was doing pretty much the same thing. I was out on my deck having a cup of tea, and Sue came in and said, "My God, something's happening in New York. You better come in." And the planes were going over, and it was a very strange thing. And poetry can really take you back to those places, can't it?
Well, I have been writing poems as my main work for about 40 years now, maybe 50 years. And I've always, thought this was my real work. But, poetry, which always occupies my mind every day, doesn't get much attention. And if you don't spend a lot of time going around giving readings and publishing the poems necessarily in magazines and playing part of the poetry world, you're sort of on the outside of it to some degree. And I've been somewhat, in a happy way, plagued by the fact that my novels and biographies have received so much ridiculous attention that it's been very hard for the poems to lift their little heads up and say hello. But, it's really, to me, the important work is writing the poems and letting the language be really adequate to the experience of people in our time.
Yeah. You, as a poet, certainly in this range that I'm referring to here, and you've just explained to us what a villanelle is, you use lots of different forms and structures, lots of different prosody all the way through this. I won't bore the listeners with those technicalities, but you almost try everything on the planet, don't you?
I really do write formal verse. I write villanelles and sonnets and rhyme stanzas in the vein of Robert Frost, whose biography I wrote. But really, I write free verse. I write all kinds of poetry, including a lot of political poetry. During the period of the Iraq War, I wrote a lot of very angry, fierce political poetry, and I thought that was appropriate in that moment.
Yeah,
poetry that really, questioned.
It certainly was.
American motives, which I do and did.
You did that, but you also teach. You are a teacher, and there's a lot of teaching that takes place, I think, beneath the surface of a lot of these poems. I got a real sense of, I always get a sense that you are very adept at the subtext. You're always saying what you don't mean, but meaning what you say. And I really like that about poetry in general, but you do it awfully well. How aware are you of that, and how do you revise to make that stronger when you're working on a poem?
Well, you know, I've got two things I always say about my own poems, that I want them to be musical, and I want them to begin somewhere in space and corkscrew through space and end somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I need movement, and I need a certain music. Robert Frost used to say, a poem has to have a tune. And even the most free verse poem of mine will very much carry a very idiosyncratic tune that hopefully will stick in people's heads. But then also it's got to be appropriate to the subject matter.
Yeah.
So I'm always trying to revise my poems in the direction of making them clearer as well. I can't stand it that poetry is often so obscure.
Yeah.
I think that one of the reasons poetry has failed the public so badly in the last 100 years is that poets have, you know, willfully gone off into realms of obscurity that are quite unnecessary.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, so as a result, hundreds of thousands of readers who would have been there for poetry long ago just, you know, happened to glance at, say, a poem in the New Yorker and say, oh my God, that's not for me. Who wants to mess with that stuff?
Yeah.
And so they never read it again. And I think that's a real shame.
It's very different in this country, too. I mean, when you think of poets in somewhere like the old Soviet Union, Russia, they'll fill football stadiums for a reading. You know,
I was amazed by that. I've met some of those famous Russian poets, and they used to tell me they would read to 100,000, 200,000 yeah. people sometimes.
Yeah, would that could come
you know,
here?
This country, you know, you're lucky if you gather a room of 50 people and give a reading.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love doing that because I do feel when I gather a room of 50 or 100 people and give a reading, believe me, they leave that 45 minutes to an hour understanding, you know, why poetry matters and how it works and how it's meant to be language that really rings and resonates and digs into people's experience and takes them into, extends their experience in ways they never would have thought possible.
So after all this talk, let's have you read After the Terror again, because you've just described what a villanelle is, and we've had this little talk. I love what Robert Bly always does. I don't know how familiar you are with him, but he'll always have at a poetry reading, he'd always read it twice, maybe sometimes three times. And
well,
I think that's very smart.
Idea. I'll read it again.
Yeah.
After the Terror. Everything has changed, though nothing has. They've changed the locks on almost every door, and windows have been bolted just in case. It's business as usual, someone says. Is anybody left to mind the store? Everything has changed, though nothing has. The same old buildings huddle in the haze with faces at the windows floor by floor, the windows they have bolted just in case. No cause for panic, they maintain, because the streets go places they have been before. Everything has changed, though nothing has. We're still a country that is ruled by laws. The system's working, and it's quite a bore that windows have been bolted just in case. Believe in victory and all that jazz. Believe we're better off, that less is more. Everything has changed, though nothing has. The windows have been bolted just in case.
And that's your 9/11 poem.
You know, I read that poem recently in Egypt on a tour I was on, and it was a huge room full of students. Most they all spoke English. And there must have been hundreds of them there. And I started reading the poem, and they're so used to the way poetry works in the Arab world, where they're so attuned to language, that by the end of the poem, they were saying the refrain lines with me.
When
I got to the last two lines, everything has changed, though nothing has, they were saying with me, the windows have been bolted, just in case.
Yeah.
And I was startled. I mean, there would never be an American audience where they would catch on so quickly. But it's because we've lost the sense of what poetic language is and how it functions and how it can dig into the skin and really rapidly transform us.
Well, we're trying to bring it back on this show. So I love this poem. There's all sorts of evocative things in it that bring back that day 16 years ago. It's amazing to me. And nothing has changed, as you say in the poem. and the doors are bolted, and we're huddling. It's certainly very interesting, and I went down to Lower Town. I ran the New York Marathon that year, just, you know, I guess it was November 3rd. The place was still burning, and walked around, you know, where the ruins were. And these words bring all that back to me, you know, the dusty windows, nothing had been tidied up, but, you know, it was business as usual, and people were trying to keep the stores open, and there was a healthy kind of defiance going on, but certainly it was a sense of a very ruined city. And you've amazingly captured here. How did this come about? Were you actually down there, or did you do this from...
No, I was not in. I was in Vermont on 9/11, but, you know, just, you know, like everybody, I was watching it all day long, and I think, you know, it was a profound experience for everybody in the world, not just Americans.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that whole period was so intense. Then with Bush and the invasion of Iraq, you know, everybody, I certainly was marching. In fact, I was marching in New York and Washington, even in London, against the invasion of Iraq. And then I was so startled that we did this stupid thing, which one could see, you know, it was both predictable and predicted that we would have, you know, consequences that would go down several decades, you know, with hundreds of thousands killed and chaos in the Middle East, and, you know, veterans, you know, wounded for decades to come, and amazing amounts of ill will. And it was so astonishing that not long after Bush invaded Iraq, and I had, you know, written vividly, I thought about how against it and protested the war, and I was with the poets against the war, and then I got an invitation to come to the White House and read a poem.
To George Bush.
George Bush by the Bush White House. And so can I read the one, The President Eats Breakfast Alone?
Go ahead.
This is the one I sent. They said, please write an original poem and send it in. And this is the one I sent in. The President Eats Breakfast Alone. This is in total free verse. The President sips coffee all alone in his White House. The cameras cannot invade his mind. He doesn't understand why some won't cheer when he cries war against the enemies of right and good. The bombs must fall. The helicopters must arrive in clusters and conclude their efforts. We will show real mercy in the end. We don't want war. Not war exactly, he explains politely to the other president who lives inside him. He adjusts his tie. We want the terror just to go away. We are the terror, somebody has said. How can this be? We're free and easy. We have walked our little kids to school. On Sundays in the park, we toss the balls. The president admires the silver spoon beside his cup. His room is cool and bright and quiet. He has been elected after all. His body is a powerful machine. His eyes are steady and his hands are clean.
Mm. And you read that to him?
You know, it's no wonder when I sent that in, I got a call from Mrs. Bush's office. Her secretary disinvited me.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah, I was disinvited. They said I couldn't read this poem.
Oh, yeah. Well, you just read it.
So it's curious how you know, we've got a culture that's very averse to criticism. I mean, of course, now we live in the craziest times imaginable right at this very moment.
Yes. We do. It's very, very difficult, and you know, with the Republican convention going on, I can't even watch it. I mean, it's I can't believe I'm actually.
You know, it's language gone askew. I mean, poetry is the opposite of that. Language is the language of poetry is language that has gone not askew, but which has been assembled and carefully cultivated, where the speaker is aware of the history of words, where words have a kind of resonance and depth to them. Where you're gathering images and developing thoughts, where arguments are, you know, tidied up and carried through. And, you know, now we've got, you know, Trump spewing this kind of verbal, you know, hash, which is, you know, the exact opposite of poetry.
Yeah. We were talking the other day, and this fits in a little bit, about Ezra Pound. And here we are, some of us here on the left are a little bit worried about a return to some sort of fascism. And you wrote a poem about Ezra Pound, which is on your page 29.
Yeah, well, what was going on was about back in, I left America for 7 years when I was in my earliest 20s, and barely 20, I left, and I stayed away for 7 years. And I was living for a part of it in Italy, and I was in Venice, and I used to work in a cafe right by one of the canals there in Venice. It's all canals. And this old man used to brush by me every day, and he had, you know, strawberry hair and white beard, and was walking with a cane, and I had a big cape on. And I said to Giorgio, the waiter who worked, I knew very well, I said, this old man, he walks by me every day, and he's muttering, and I realize he's saying under his breath, I can hear fragments of what I think are the Dante's Divine Comedy. Is that possible? He said, oh, yes, he has great interest in poetry. In fact, he's an American poet. His name is Ezra Pound.
Uh-huh.
And so I never said a word to him. He seemed mad as a hatter. But I would watch him walking by my table, and for years I scribbled bits and pieces of this poem. Do you want me to read that poem?
Yes, I do.
It's bits and pieces of, I've read Pound over half a century and thought about his crazy career. He was a fascist. He was put in a cage in Pisa by General Mark Clark. He was put on trial in Washington, D.C., condemned to death, given a reprieve because he was mad. He was in jail. He was in a mental asylum for 10 years, then released and deported, wound up back in Italy again, half mad. So this is called To Ezra Pound, Venice, 1969. On the Calle dei Fabbri, in ripening dusk, I heard you coming, glib old geezer, almost 85. You passed my table, leaning on your stick, repeating in a whisper broken lines, nel dritto mezzo, while I sipped espresso, writing in a notebook, thick with silence, filling up a void with my own chat. Frail, grizzly, red beard, Barbarosso in a wide-brimmed hat and velvet cloak, you swished beside me, reeking of old wax and brittle parchment. And the bells above San Marco beat, Venetian side streets folded on themselves, hexangular in shadows, smoke light, lapping water, low-hung skies, with claims and counterclaims that trailed behind you as before through rambling decades as you fought for this or that lost cause, some odd, some noble, some unhinged. Cui domo lapidem novem libellum. You asked a number of good questions, wading into dusk through scattered passages. You were still afraid of what comes next, that room of readers, large or small, no consolation for the motley decades, what was said and done, undone. You saw the silver underside of heaven, writing in your cage through nights in Pisa, shivering in black rain of your making, as you cursed the economics of another age, that bitch gone sour, tooth and gum, with profits taken, though of course unearned. It was not enough to run the numbers when so many died, mothers and fathers with their daughters, sons in blood-whelmed camps. Nel dritto mezzo del campo e maligno, and the pits were largo e profundo. Ezra, dwindling compound ghost, you never understood that God is everywhere and all vengeance must belong to him.
Unbelievable. That's such a great poem. And did that came out of notes that you took at the time in 79?
Well, I certainly was scribbling bits and pieces of this poem off and on for 40 years, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's a fabulous poem. It's rather long, so I won't have you read that one again. Tell us a little bit more about the Italian in there and the sense of his history that you put into the poem.
Well, you know, it's a poem about I'm trying to come to terms with this shadow of Ezra Pound, with this character who, you know, really does profoundly represent modern poetry in some weird way. He is the kind of godfather of modern poetry. He, of course, was the editor and friend of T.S. Eliot and James Joyce and so many others, Hemingway.
Yeah.
And Robert Frost, even. He brought Robert Frost into print. So he had a profound influence on modern American and world letters. He was a brilliant critic and thinker. And yet he sort of, his mind went scattered and he became extremely fascist and finally, you know, became a follower of Mussolini and made broadcasts for Mussolini during World War II, which is why they put him in a cage in Pisa. And he wrote those insanely beautiful poems, the Pisan Cantos, while in a cage in Pisa.
It's incredible.
And I just think his whole life is an astonishing morality tale of some kind. And, you know, what he came to in the end. And
do you think he was really mad or just so right-wing that we can't understand him?
Well, you know, he's so right-wing and so crazy, you know, and so brilliant and yet so nuts, you know.
So he'd probably be at the Republican convention, wouldn't he?
I think he would love Donald Trump.
He was really big on the idea
of the strong man. And, you know, the masses, when they feel frustrated and frightened, look to the strong man, and they see this, you know, I mean, Trump is really a potentially fascist dictator.
Absolutely. Well, here's another one of these poems that really resonated with me. Many of them did, but I think this is a fun one for you to talk about. It's called Lost Poems. It's on your page 33.
Yeah, the Lost Poems. See, let me just see if I can. Do you know what page that's on?
Page 33. By the way, this is a gorgeous book. Congratulations to your publishers. It's just a beautiful, absolutely lovely piece of art, this book.
You know, I was so thrilled that after all this time, you know, I didn't know if I'd even get the damn poem, the book of poems published, but Beacon Press leapt on it and did the whole thing.
Well,
and
good for them.
They did a beautiful job. It goes poems going back to things I wrote in the mid-70s. Actually, I realized one of them, which is a translation I did from Ovid's Amores, I think I wrote that in 1973.
they've done a fabulous job.
Some of them a long time. But, I mean, you know, the thing is, every morning I get up and I work in my notebooks and I write endless poems, most of them fragments, bits and pieces, and I think of poems when I'm stepping into the shower or lying in bed in the middle of the night, and I say, should I get up and write that down? I think, no, I'll remember it in the morning, and I never do. And I feel like my life is so full of these lost poems, failed enterprises, and so this poem is called The Lost Poems. I mourn those lost and lovely poems, the ones not written, left to founder in the phase of time. They came too easily, perhaps, the fragrant lines, the granite images, all the lively phrases never turned to sums. They felt as real as what I write now, maybe more so, being fragmentary, flushed to flame. They came and went as I stepped awkwardly into a bath or looked around me on the gravel path, or turn my back toward a wall of sleep. Their vanishing was eerily complete. It took so little just to lose their thread, and I'm still missing what was almost said.
I so identify with
Don't you think we all have that, where you know, we have thoughts that just scamper away?
Especially, you know, the life
vanish like fog, burned off.
The time between sleep and waking is just amazing, and these things.
Yeah, I suspect that we're all Milton's and Shakespeare's between 4 a.m. and 7 a.m.
Well, we've got a few seconds. We've got a few seconds left, but on my I do it now on my iPhone, and I got Dragon, so that I speak these things now into Dragon. It's not really helping because I forget to use the Dragon, but it's one way to do it. Jay, once again, thanks so much for being on the show. I love this book, New and Collected Poems, 1975 to 2015. Jay Perini, thanks so much once again for being on Right on Radio.
Well, thank you, Ian, for having me on.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
And now this.
Support for KFAI comes from the Dakota, presenting Nina Freeland, Saturday, September 6th. Jazz singer, composer, producer, and arranger Nina Freeland returns to the Dakota stage with her latest release, Beneath the Skin, a jazz album that brushes against blues and soul with intimacy, honesty, deep emotion, and quiet wisdom. It's a personal musical statement rooted in tradition, but always forward-thinking. More information about Nina Freeland at the Dakota can be found at dakotacooks.com.
Today I have Paul Kruse and Shelby Richardson, the playwright and director, respectively, of Hot Dish here at KFAI's Right on Radio. Thank you so much for being here, you two.
Thanks for having us, Emma.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. Thanks for having us here.
So this is going to be really, really fun. Can both of you describe, or Paul, can you describe the concept of Hot Dish?
Yeah, absolutely. So Hot Dish is a surreal farce, is what we're calling it. About and for the women who raised me and who made me, who I grew up with. And so it follows a group of Midwestern women who we meet at a potluck. And one of them has recently died, but showed up anyway. And then the Virgin Mary comes out of a refrigerator, and we learn pretty quickly is running a multi-level marketing scheme. And the play just gets a little stranger from there. And I could say the play, I grew up in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I'm from the upper Midwest. And I've been lucky to move back to live in Minneapolis, to be near family again. And so my downstairs neighbors are actually one of my brothers and his family. I've two other brothers who live in the area, and my parents are close by, and my extended family is all here. And so I've, in the last 5 years, just been immersed in family. And so I've been thinking a lot about kind of, what the culture of this place is and been writing about it. But yeah.
Awesome. So that's like kind of the, for a lot of artists, it is very common at a certain point in their life to kind of go back to their roots or like to their home places. I think it was Samuel D. Hunter. He wrote like Pocatello, Boise, the Case of Existence for God, I think. And I remember watching like one of his interviews because he grew up in Idaho. Oddly enough, I went to grad school in Pocatello too. So I'm like kind of curious about like all these Idaho plays. And he always mentions going back to like kind of childhood nostalgia and like kind of coming from that earnest place as a writer. And I always think, yeah, this is like kind of like looking at parallels between your playwriting, your plays, and then kind of his as well. It's like there's like that unique parallel.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I admire Sam's work immensely. Like that's it. Yeah. I've had the chance to meet him once over Zoom.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He's just a really generous person. Just a really, really cool. And he's also I think running a new residency out of Idaho, trying to get more playwrights to make work, you know, in and about the West is my understanding, which is really cool.
That's really, really cool. I'm really glad to hear that. Shelby, can you explain how you ended up with this project?
Totally. Yeah. Well, Paul saw a piece I directed called Rich Dogs, which was at the Jungle in the fall of 2023 that I did with my former company, We Are Married. And that was my first main stage directing piece that I had been a part of the devising process. So the creators and I devised that show together and put it up in the Jungle lobby in 2023, and Paul happened to see it, and then we
away. It was amazing.
That's so sweet. Yeah. And then I was surprised to be asked to direct Hot Dish when it was we were working on it at the Playwright Center, because you were a fellow there, Paul, until recently. So the last couple of years you were in fellowship there, and I really was excited that you had that insight, Paul, of me directing your work, because there's a lot of sympathy between what I think you and I are both interested in. So that it worked out really well and has felt really kind of swimming. You know, sometimes people approach you and it's flattering always. It's always nice to be asked. And it's sometimes not always exactly the right fit. And then it was so exciting to know that, wow, this is, I think, really enhancing my work. And I'm really flattered and grateful to have, it's always nice to have someone take a chance on you, no matter what stage you are in your career. It's always a chance. So yeah, that was, that's how I got involved in it. And then the Jungle was generous to let us have a reading there in their Greenhouse series. So that's been thrilling. Yeah.
Yeah. I just kind of want to ask about the Greenhouse series, which I know is like kind of the Jungle's newer, I think it started last year. Somebody can kind of correct me on that. Yeah. I think it started last year. Can you explain what a greenhouse, like a reading series, is to maybe some of our listeners who aren't familiar with what that means in like theater language?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, so to do an entire production of a play is so involved and such a huge investment. So a lot of people, a lot of companies want to kind of hear it aloud, almost like a literary, they want to hear the play as a literary object to understand what is this about? Is our audience going to have sympathy with this? They want to invest a little bit before they invest a huge amount of money to produce a show. So maybe that's the sort of, banal way of explaining it. But I do think that is part of the impetus for having these readings is let's see, let's do a little bit and then let's see what people think. I think the other impetus is creative, is like, let's cast a wide net and let's like experiment with some stuff. I think when you're investing in a reading, you can swing for the fences and play with something that is perhaps more out there, a little more surreal, a little more unexpected than you can when you're trying to build a season. So that I think is part of what The Jungle is trying to do. What do you think, Paul? I mean, this kind of gets into like, what are play readings? Like, I think people in theater know what they are. And then I found that people not in theater don't necessarily know what they are. Yeah, it can be kind of odd.
Yeah, I think in addition to all those, everything you said about, you know, the reasons for the Jungle hosting this event live alongside what a gift it is. It's a huge gift that the Jungle is offering to me as a writer, and I think to us as a collaborative team, because it's so funny. Like, plays are such weird creatures in that you write them, but rarely do people encounter the text. Like, rarely does the thing I write get experienced. What gets experienced are like a production, actors, design. People experience how that text inspires another group of artists. And so what a reading does is it allows me to have, without the big investment of a production, as Shelby said, it allows me to experience what the play might sound like, literally sound like, and then also what those sounds do to a room full of people. I like to say that my job as a playwright is to get a small group of artists excited about a story. Like, my audience are the artists I work with. So like directors, actors, designers. And if I'm lucky enough to work with people who find my writing interesting or who want to engage with things that I write down, I think the magic actually happens when those things come alive in a room, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I believe that does. I've was only introduced to like a group reading. It was The Jungle last year, and it was for their Tulipa reading, which I thought was very, very magical and very engaging. And just like somebody like me to kind of have easy access to a theater space as well.
Yeah, well, and I also want to just really express gratitude to Christina Baldwin and Allison Ruth and Issa Tejeda and all the folks who we've been lucky enough to work with at The Jungle. They've really been wonderful advocates for this work too. And they continue to make, you know, incredible work. I just really love this theater a lot.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful theater too inside.
It's gorgeous in there. It really gives you this feeling of like prestige to be in there, which feels really good. And they also are a house in town that is so committed to new local work and excellence in new playmaking, which is not common because it's expensive and risky. So they're consistently advocates for that type of work that is a little bit boundary pushing, that is going to be a little bit unfamiliar for the audience. And they do a wonderful job at kind of synthesizing what feels good for people and what is new and kind of pushes them. So they're very great advocates for all the people Paul just named. Yeah, you're
awesome. One of the questions I had about Hot Dish is that it is a all women play, like it's all women casted. And you mentioned earlier that this is basically about the woman in your life. Was there any thought of like having a priest or a father within the play itself? Because it does have like a big Catholic heavy influence in there.
Yeah, there. Well, and I should say this is maybe a spoiler. There is one man who is in our cast.
Okay.
But what's so interesting? I think my experience of the church is so embedded and mediated through women, which feels like such a contradiction because I think of it as a profoundly misogynistic kind of institution. But through my mother's faith, through the faith of the sisters and nuns who taught us, it very much also became my foundational understanding of feminism in a lot of ways. And I think what this play is grappling with for me, and of course I am grappling with this as a cisgender man, and so there are things that I've been really grateful to the collaborators I've been working with to help me understand more deeply an experience that I haven't had, which is that, of being a woman in the church. But it's grappling with that contradiction of this big institution of, and not just the institution of the church, but the institution of gender, and, the institution of being, being gendered in the Midwest, which is, I think, a really specific thing. And Shelby, I'm kind of curious for you. I think I'm in the weeds a little bit in this play too. And so I'm curious, Shelby, like what experiences you've had about gender and this play in the Midwest.
Yeah. Like, so I'm not a woman, I'm trans non-binary. So I often, find myself checking myself, I guess, and going, oh, okay, well, that's not exactly me. But I feel affiliation with women and was raised around them and was sort of raised to be one. So sort of transgressive in that regard. But I think too, less than gender, I'm thinking a lot about like care with the play because that's been part of your framing, Paul. So it's like it's a privilege to care for people. It's also a privilege to receive care. So it's just like, who is receiving and giving at that level of care? And yeah, Paul, it's fascinating. It's like, on the one hand, Catholicism is this incredibly patriarchal and misogynistic institution. Then on the other hand, same. Like, I was raised Catholic and it was like, who was I interacting with? I was interacting with like the CDC teacher, like the catechism teacher, who were all women. I was interacting with like the people that were organizing the, like the evening activities, which were like my only experience of community in a rural town where I was going to the like Polish Catholic church with my babshi, who was insistent that we went twice a week. Like, so all of this was mediated through women, even though it was this incredibly patriarchal institution. So, and that was my entire contact with community care, with kind of learning new things through the church, and with understanding how to function in like a faith-based community. That was entirely women. That there was almost no contact with men. So it was this bizarre gendered thing, but what men were like, irrelevant and excluded. Like there was no, yeah, I don't know. So that was kind of my experience. So it doesn't strike me as like peculiar at all, or it doesn't stick out to me. It seems almost like high realism, like extremely exact realism. I think that, and then I guess I've had the privilege of being involved in a lot of productions that are huge casts of women or gender non-conforming people. So like I've been involved in a lot of casts that are that do like heavily skew towards women. So yeah, that.
Yeah, I guess I was going to use this as a follow-up question for like the large cast. Like, how was it casting this play? Because there is just a lot of women. I know for like one of my plays that I worked on, it was like a light board operator, but it was called Men on Boats. And that's a gender swath one where it's a large cast of women or non-binary folks. So can you explain how you got to that for this production?
How we cast it? Yeah.
Yeah, Shelby, I would love for Shelby to answer this. They have just been working so hard to cast with the, the help of the folks at the Jungle. So.
Well, okay. Something that is interesting about casting is it seems as though, and I'm young in my career, but it seems very much as though no one individual is casting everything. Without fail, I'm having to go to Issa and say, yo, Issa, I need someone who looks like this, who can do this. And they're going, oh, I know five people. The amazing thing about the Twin Cities is we are stacked with women who are very, very good. Like phenomenally good actors. We are absolutely stacked with that. I think when you first showed me the play, Paul, I was like, well, we could cast this four different ways here. Like we could have, there are 40 people that could fill each of these roles. So that in one sense was easy. And then in another sense, it's also challenging because your voice, I think, is so specific, Paul. So it's not every single actor can do every single thing. You want to find people who are going to thrive in the role that they've been given. And that's like a delicate art form that I'm just very starting to learn. So that's, I think, fascinating. It was very fun to go through the casting process and think of everyone and go, oh, would they be great at this? Would they thrive with this person? Like, is the chemistry there? It's a wonderful and kind of interestingly artistic part of the process. But everyone gets help with casting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
That's my thing. Yeah.
Paul, do you have any other thoughts or extra comments on that? Or
God, no, I just have gratitude. I mean, both for Shelby's work and then also what actors do is pretty magical. I have tried, and it is not something that I am skilled at. I just admire it is just really courageous to put your body and your voice in front of people. Like, that is a really courageous act that I often cannot do. which is why I love to have the control of writing something down and then having other people be looked at. So yeah, no, I think it's just gratitude is what I want to say.
Awesome. I want to add to that, which is just to say that your plays demand vulnerability of people first, and then they also demand that they show that they're experts something. So it's cool, Paul, because you get to see people really broken down in your plays, and then you get to see them like excel and be heroes and excellent. So that's also a fun challenge. I'm an actor myself, and it's that's thrilling. Those are the kinds of roles you want. So Paul's definitely writing those, the kind of parts that you want, I think, as an actor or as an actress. Yeah.
I had a question for Paul about just kind of like writing comedy or like surrealistic kind of comedy. Yeah. I've heard, I'm not a writer. I did a lot more technical writing, but I've always heard in the creative process, like writing's like, comedy's like the hardest thing to write. The first to age the worst, just due to like kind of the context sometimes it's created in. Have you done a lot of comedies in your past work? Do you even plan to do more comedies, surrealistic kind of type of work like this? And how does Hot Dish kind of fit into your creative process?
Yeah, I think I love to experience comedy. I also love funny people, and I love being around people who are funny. And I feel like kind of really since maybe even a little bit before the pandemic, I've been using pleasure as a guide in my own work and what is pleasurable to bring people together. And I think comedy fits that. I've heard that also, that comedy is hard to write. I think that's true. I think the thing you need to be writing is always the easiest and hardest thing to write, which is why you need to be writing it. I think that is, I think sometimes maybe what people are talking about too is that in writing comedy, often there's an attention to craft. And by craft, I mean writing in a way where that you're conscious of how something sounds, of literally how like a sentence will land. I've been, you know, really, really lucky to have a couple of opportunities recently to learn more about that. I taught a class, and I was a fellow at the Playwright Center called Jokes for Plays, where we got an amazing group of folks together. And over the course of 6 weeks, we just looked at different joke structures, literally starting with knock-knock jokes. And finally, I mean, the result was like we destroyed comedy because, you know, we like are pulling things apart. And why does that make you laugh? And so often what makes people laugh is surprise, social connection, Discomfort, the release of tension, often is what makes folks laugh. I feel like a novice in the world of comedy. I only recently, kind of in the last maybe 5 to 6 years, went from someone who kind of wrote plays that made people chuckle to like saying out loud, I am writing a play and the goal of this play is to make people laugh. It's new. And I think to answer your question, yeah, I hope to keep writing comedies.
And a kind of another follow-up question, especially in the plot of the play, where it's like MLM schemes are extremely common in church groups. It seems like it's a very universal church universal kind of culture. But like when I went to Idaho, it was like the Mormons had a lot of MLM schemes, evangelical. Was there a reason, was like just like, oh, you know, if I'm setting a church with women, an MLM scheme is going to have to be involved somehow? Was that just like, I'm assuming like kind of a natural thought process towards that? Or yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of in the vein of like the hot dish in the kitchen and the Virgin Mary, of just things that seem like women's property in the middle of the country that just, I'm thinking about like Tupperware and Mary Kay, Avon, and, you know, even Primerica. It's just, there is a gendered quality to it that I think is scary and interesting. And that's where that came from. And then there also was this way, so I looked at a lot of Marian apparitions. In thinking about this, I watched this movie that they showed us. So I went to Catholic school, K-12, and one of the movies they showed us was The Song of Bernadette, which I think is from the 20s or 30s. I should look. I actually don't know when it was made. But it's about a Marian apparition. And the structure of a lot of these Marian apparitions feel to me like an MLM scheme. Where she appears to often the most powerless person in a community and has demands that they go and build a church somewhere. And it does kind of feel like the way that a Mary Kay salesperson might approach a potential sales associate. There's a quality of like, I want something from you. I need you to do something for me. And you are someone with not a lot of power. It seems like it's at the heart of a lot of Marian apparitions that happen. I'm thinking of like the Virgin of Guadalupe and Our Lady of Lourdes, Our Lady of Church. Like it's really interesting to me.
I never would have thought of that, but that is actually kind of a really interesting connection. I am going to probably wrap up here pretty soon. I do have one last kind of question here is, I'm not from the Midwest. I'm not from the upper Midwest. I did not know what a hot dish was until I moved here, which caused me some Googling. And I have to have like a hot dish recipe, but I did not know this. Is there like, there's a cheese on top of the tater tots. And then some people don't put cheese on top of the tater tots. And do you put cheese on top of your tater tots or not cheese on top of the tater tots? Your own personal tot dish recipe.
Well, I got to say, Shelby, you go.
Well, I'm not from here, right? So I'm still learning this hot dish type stuff, that there's a starch, there's some kind of vegetable, some kind of meat, and then cheese.
Yeah.
So that's like the extent. I think I made one tater tot hot dish before. It was delicious. I think I did put cheese on top. What do you do, Bob?
You know, I grew up, the word hot dish to me applies to any manner of things that gets baked and eaten. Sometimes involving tater tots, sometimes not. But I will say, if cheese is an option, I'm from Wisconsin, always there is cheese involved. But I do think in other parts of the country, we call this a casserole, which can be a lot of different things. So that's what I grew up understanding, was that a hot dish can, you know, I have a memory of someone once making a lasagna and calling it a hot dish.
What?
That's so anything else, the culture gets completely erased and subsumed into
the category of hot dish.
Beautiful. Lasagna hot dish. Oh my God. That Oh, that's I don't know how I feel about that.
Right.
But the tater tot one is that's classic. That's the
Yeah. I always thought hot dish always had a hat tater tots, and I
it
guess
definitely it, helps.
Yeah. Can't
throw them in. Yeah. Why not?
Throw them in. Also, a lot of canned soups. You get canned soups and vegetables involved.
There we go.
Canned mushroom is the one that I've always that's what I use.
Yeah.
It had to be Campbell's brand for some reason.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Loyalty, brand loyalty.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of like the other thing that I think Midwesterners do in cuisine that is just baffling is what we call salads. Like really anything that you can throw in a bowl and eat with a fork could be a salad. It really is broad. Doesn't need to have vegetables involved at all.
Yeah, like a Snickers salad.
Sweet, savory. The thing that boggles me is the sweet, savory crossover. It's kind of like the salad can be very sweet. It's fine. Yeah,
that's fine.
That's fine.
Salad. Yeah.
Right. A lot.
Thank you, Paul and Shelby, for your time with us today. Hot Dish will be performing at the Jungle Theater September 8th. That is a Monday. Tickets and more information can be found at thejungletheater.org. If there is a chance of a sellout risk, you can always hang out near the box office and see if you can snag yourself a last-minute ticket. All right, folks, thank you so much. This was Right on Radio.
Coffee dessert, yes, you know it's good news.